diverse, independent, yours. You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, British Columbia.
Welcome to this week's episode of the Canadian Philosophy Show. My name is Hale. I'm your host for this episode, but with me as well is Brandon. So we talked quite extensively on the last episode about, you know, the modernist movement in the late 19th century, but especially the first half of the 20th century, where the kind of classics of what we consider sort of modern aesthetic building style, very plain, squared off, often terraced, lots of room for lighting, but deeply simple, were in many ways a reflection of the idealized versions of science, right? Of spaces like factories and laboratories, or trying to even understand people as, you know, what do we imagine the most efficient scientific, quote unquote, space for living would look like, right? Like if we, instead of basing architectural desires and ideas off of more of a presumably emotional stance, as we saw, or as in a more traditional sense, as we saw in particular, associated with Romanticism, but especially with, sort of classicist architecture, which was really the various forms of that were really the kind of dogma for centuries and centuries. Instead, we started to see architects like the French modernist Le Corbusier trying to make the most efficient, the most effective, the most scientifically thought out living space. We also kind of realized that these were more than anything idealizations, and that the way that buildings speak to us, the way that we understand them, are often really more reflective of the virtues and things that we idolize in society, rather than actually being particularly effective at what they're set out to do in their very specific ways. You know, modernist homes, which were supposed to be the most efficient, the most effective places for living, often looked very beautiful and were very aesthetically interesting and really brought up both in the person who lived in them and still, frankly, today in those who see photos and try to visualize these spaces, brought up this sense of that kind of modern, scientific, industrial world. But in terms of actual places to live in, they were often very problematic and not the most actually that effective. The classic example, Le Corbusier, as he insisted on having flat terrace roofs, which were notorious, well, which he wanted because, you know, they would allow for living space and sort of greatly expand the footprint of the house and allow people to go outside into nature above their own home and all that kind of stuff, but were also notorious for leaking and, you know, basically making these spaces oftentimes unlivable because they just were not practical. A lot of this stuff is less to do about being literally scientific or, say, literally classicist, if we look even farther back, and more giving the appearance of or inspiring us those thoughts and feelings that we associate with those movements and those worlds rather than really doing the things themselves. So we really wanted to expand on this discussion and bring some new sort of thinkers into the mix. I know Brandon especially does. So I'll pass it off to him to see where this discussion will really go from where we've already taken it.
Yeah, thanks for that, Hale. It's a good summary of what we've been discussing so far. I think it's a good reminder that we are kind of talking about aesthetics in a broad sense, but seen through the lens of architecture. So obviously this is a small series on the philosophy of architecture, but it's difficult to talk about philosophy in a sort of narrow sense. It loves to get generalized. We'll be talking about aesthetics and aesthetic theory in general, but try to focalize it through architecture. So we'll touch on lots of areas, but specifically one of the architects that you actually brought up at the beginning of this series and that I was quite interested in because of his situation in modern architecture and as a modernist architect was Frank Lloyd Wright. Now, when you look at Frank Lloyd Wright's buildings, and if you can just see it in his buildings, but specifically from his interviews as well, he aspires to many of the same things that modern architects like Le Corbusier aspire to as well, a sort of they're almost kind of like Enlightenment thinkers of architecture. They take the sovereignty of the individual very seriously. They want to kind of highlight and not necessarily put on a pedestal. They want architecture to reflect a kind of humanism. Frank Lloyd Wright wants to do that as well, but it's very clear that he's doing that differently than most modernist architects, and especially Le Corbusier. Not just from listening to his interviews, his architecture does reflect that. I'm thinking specifically of his probably most famous building, Falling Water, which is situated essentially on top of a river. It's incorporated into nature, whereas Le Corbusier's buildings don't have the kind of consideration for their surroundings that Frank Lloyd Wright does. It's interesting that Frank Lloyd Wright is doing that situated architecture out of modernist sensibilities, and Le Corbusier is also taking a kind of contextless approach to architecture, also from modernist sensibility. So I was wondering, okay, like, what is going on here? Like, both of them are arguably doing modernism, but I'm wondering why Le Corbusier is doing it differently than Frank Lloyd Wright. Now, I think one of the answers is that Frank Lloyd Wright is in the future to Le Corbusier, so he has the opportunity to respond to Le Corbusier, and in that way, I kind of think of him as a bit of a renegade modernist. So that's one thing, but we have to understand what he's responding to. And so I'm not an architect, but I am a philosopher, like I'm a philosophy student. I'm interested in aesthetic philosophy. So I went and looked at a little bit of Le Corbusier's work, a bit of the history of his work. I noticed a kind of strain running throughout some of his pieces, and also I looked at some of his actual thoughts. Beginning at the beginning of Le Corbusier's career, you can see him setting up, and it really anticipates. So the first piece that I'm going to talk about from Le Corbusier's collection of works, and I mean, it's interesting to think of buildings as works, but they are a part of his portfolio. The first thing that I noticed as like a significant modernist project for Le Corbusier was what was called Le Domino. And what the Domino is essentially a floor plan. Now, it's basically just a floor plan. So what it is three concrete slabs all stacked on top of each other with distance made by concrete pillars in them, and at the back of the building is a flight of stairs to each slab. It doesn't have exterior walls, so it is completely open, but what Le Corbusier intended for this building was essentially to give as much freedom to anyone who was to occupy this building. So one of the other thing too was that it's not just the freedom to put what you want in it, but actually, if you want to put the windows where you want to put them, there's no exterior wall built into this. So the person who owns this Domino can construct the outer wall how they want. They can put the windows where they want. They can put the floor plan where they want. And they can do this because the floors are actually supported by the concrete beams. So we're already seeing some anticipations of, in the 20s, his later five principles. You already see this anticipated in the Domino. Now, it's called the Domino for a couple reasons. One, it's actually kind of a pun. So Domino, the first part, Dom, it borrows from the Latin domus, which means home. The other is that it kind of looks like a domino, or it looks like dominoes. The concrete slabs line up one after the other, so they look like dominoes. But the other thing is it doesn't just resemble dominoes, which direction would that be? Vertically, sorry. It's also intended to be reproduced next to each other. So you build them one after the other after the other, and you build kind of little suburbs of these dominoes. So you line up the houses themselves in dominoes. And what this was supposed to be was a, so it was supposed to be a kind of humanitarian or humanist contribution, that here is a, if you want to build places to live, here's a very simple floor plan. Take this, go to where people live, build it, and let them live in those spaces and let them construct them how they want. Now, the interesting thing about this is it already exists at a certain level of abstraction, right? So it doesn't really consider certain geographical or urban or cultural sort of conditions. It's just a constructed floor plan. It's kind of like a really basic skeleton for a home. You can take it and you can put it anywhere, regardless of conditions, regardless of geography, regardless of anything, essentially. So it exists at a certain level of abstraction, which we're going to see taken even further when we get to probably Le Corbusier's most famous building, the Villa Savoy, and the implementation of his 5 points of architecture. We have this floor plan that is going to become even more abstract when it's not just blueprints that don't exist in any kind of context. Le Corbusier is going to move on in the 30s to construct the Villa Savoy based on his 5 points of architecture. And the 5 points of architecture for Le Corbusier are, so the first is Pilates. So if you look at Le Corbusier's buildings, and especially the Villa Savoy, you'll notice that the bottom half is upheld by columns, but in architecture they'll call them Pilates. And this gives the, so just like in the domino, the floor plan can be free because the columns are supporting all the weight. Likewise, he turns this floor plan into an abstract principle. You should have Pilates holding up all the weight so that you don't have to depend on load-bearing walls, and it gives you complete freedom to construct whatever kind of living space or situation that will accommodate the life of the person living there. So the second kind of follows on this first one, and that's the free design of the ground plan. And this is really the important thing for Le Corbusier, that things are accommodating the living space of the person, enabled by these free-floating Pilates. So the third is also kind of anticipated, and you see this all in the domino, but it comes to full fruition in the Villa Savoy, the free facade. So the since the walls aren't load-bearing, you can construct the facade or the front piece or any of the facing walls to look however you want. You can use glass if you want, because they're not load-bearing, right? The fourth is horizontal windows, which we see used very prominently in the Villa Savoy. So this gives the interior of the second floor a lot of light. It's meant to be very open. It's meant to be very spacious and kind of airy. You can open the windows if you want. It's also supposed to play on this architectural psychology of seclusion and protection. So there's a vast outside from which the person living inside is kind of protected. And the fifth one is what Hale mentioned, which is flat roofs and terraces. So you should have a flat roof because you're going to put a garden on it, right? So having a garden on the roof is, well, the roof is really the only place that you could put a garden inside of one of these buildings. So it should be flat. It gives you living space. It puts the roof to use. So it's very utilitarian, but it makes sense that a garden would exist on the top terrace. Now, just like how Hale mentioned before, this does have problems. I mean, I'm sure there are intelligent modernist architects who came along and improved the whatever design or implementation of flat roofs. But especially with the Villa Savoy, this was notorious for leaking, and the occupants of the building very frequently left it to live in more livable conditions. So unfortunately, as much as these principles were meant to be in the service of a kind of free living or an accommodation of the human person, he famously says that a house is a machine to live in. I mean, the machine is not functioning very well, apparently. But later on we see Le Corbusier take up a lot of similar principles, but he tries to construct them en masse in a building called the Unité d'Habitation, which if you at first glance, it looks like a kind of not proto apartment complex. Maybe it is like the first real apartment complex, but it looks like it looks like a single facing multiple residency building, and it follows many of the same five principles that Le Corbusier is following up on. Like the roof is flat and it is being used for community space. A lot of the floor plan is quite open, because you're working with apartment complexes, a lot of the load-bearing properties of the building are going to be in the walls, but it's also free inside. If you look inside some of the photos, they show sort of internal streets. There are spaces for living in. There are residencies and there are residential streets in these buildings. So it's quite open in a communal sense in that way. But what I'm detecting in all of this is a kind of... So the thing about all of these is that even the Unité d'Habitation gets implemented. It's a floor plan that gets implemented in lots of different places. And apparently it's quite popular. People who live in these quite enjoy living in them, so that's good. But nonetheless, you can take these enormous structures and put them in urban settings, kind of regardless of any given geographical considerations. And this seems to be the running thread of Le Corbusier's architecture, that if we just design our buildings intelligently, because humans are really ultimately the same and equal everywhere, their living needs are the same everywhere, and wherever people live, they will need these intelligently built buildings. Now, this is where Frank Lloyd Wright comes in, and he doesn't explicitly reject this, but his work rejects this. He does have to go and construct a particular building in a particular place, again, for a particular people. I mean, Le Corbusier took commissions, and when he built the Villa Savoy, he was building it for particular commissioners, though they gave him complete free rein. It's likely that he still considered who was going to be living in there. So Frank Lloyd Wright isn't really departing from Le Corbusier in that you do have to consider who is living in there sometimes. But what's unique about Frank Lloyd Wright is that he is considering specifically the geography. He doesn't have these abstract blueprints that you can just plop wherever, right? He doesn't have a domino. He doesn't have 5 points of architecture. He doesn't have any free floating principles that universally hold for all humans. And yet in some strange way, or it shouldn't be strange, but it's putting it next to how Le Corbusier cashes this principle of humanism and modernity out. It seems to be a different way of respecting humanity and of recognizing a kind of modern sensibility by going to where the people live. examining what will suit their environment, examining what people will do in this space and what they want to do in this space.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. First of all, I just want to say I really loved your synopsis of Le Corbusier. Can you say it for me one time in the listeners so I can get it right?
For sure. It's Le Corbusier.
Le Corbusier.
Le Corbusier, yeah.
So I really like the synopsis you've given on Le Corbusier and his general thought. And it's really interesting to tie these two thinkers together or sort of compare and contrast them as we're about to do in their eyes on aesthetics. But just for our listeners and to reiterate for myself, I think one of the really big things you see with Le Corbusier is, as you kind of mentioned it before, but to put it out again, like, is effectively, like, I really like the term, like, a machine for living. A house is a machine for living. And like any machine, you put it where you need it, right? Like, the determiner of the placement is, and the design is entirely come forth from a sort of from the person, but really from I think a kind of modernist humanism that you really see coming up in the late 19th and early 20th century, right? A rejection of a lot of religious themes, and a sort of incorporation of a lot of technicism and sort of, you know, techno bureaucracy and techno states and that kind of stuff. And it's really interesting as you were speaking and as I was listening to you, and as I hope maybe some of our listeners are able to as well, I was kind of looking at some of the images that are going along exactly what Brandon's talking about. Did a very good job describing them. But it's really interesting to see some of also his drawings and stuff like that of future cityscapes, which really look like a lot of the kind of classic tower block structures. These are more like plans. But some really big tower block structures for remaking the city of Paris, for example, right? And it's like straight, clear avenues, you know, 90-degree angles everywhere, huge tower blocks replicating each other, going, you know, in, you know, basically linear patterns. And so this is kind of that vision, again, of like, you know, homes, architecture. These are structures for living. These are machines for living, and they go where humans need them to go. They go where we need them. And they, in effect, in a way you could say, they kind of take over the space that they inhabit, where they're placed, right? Like they kind of dominate the area. And they really, it seems like Le Corbusier, at least from my initial readings, what I've seen and what I see through his own architecture and style and ideas we've discussed so far, gave little to no thought to the surrounding environment. As a matter of fact, I think that's probably on purpose in terms of this wider philosophical social outlook, wherein, like, yeah, like, we are creating, like, human beings are effectively a, like, synthetically existing creature, and we're creating the synthetic environments for us to live in. And obviously with Wright, you know, as we get into Wright, I just want to, like, you know, a favorite quote of mine is from him. He famously said, "I believe in God." This is Frank Lloyd Wright, by the way. "I believe in God, only I spell it nature." And so it's interesting because they're both modernists, and they actually, I was looking into it as well, their specific timelines, and they were both alive around the same time. Actually, Frank Lloyd Wright was older. He just lived. They, like, died both in the late 60s, early 70s, or I think Le Corbusier died in the mid 60s, and Frank Lloyd Wright died in the late 60s. But he was actually a little bit older. He just lived like a super long time. He like died in his 90s. But, you know, they both come from this modern tradition, but their sort of background scaping of the world and placement is very radically different. And that's going to have an influence on where, you know, what this is going to look like. And obviously you're going to talk about that. But the last thing I want to say is in our last episode, there was a lot of discussion around sort of, we previously discussed Alain de Botton's work, The Architecture of Happiness, as kind of a text for this discussion. And in our previous discussion, we talked about, like, the virtues of architecture. You might call it the virtue theory of architecture, where basically you have architecture expresses particular kinds of character traits that you could often describe people as having as well, people or societies. And those sort of, you know, your buildings, you kind of see either them reflect what's there, or perhaps even more often than not, reflect what is not there, what is lacking in a society, or what we're striving for as a kind of space which ideally would make the goals of achieving our ideals more realistic or seem more plausible. And I think in both of these architects, that really rings true, because you really can see these two sort of opposing views of, like, almost like an anti-naturalism or almost like an ignorance of naturalism and a deep commitment to naturalism being sort of entwined with modernism, really being obviously displayed between these two modernist architects.
Yeah, and this is a really good dichotomy to be focusing on, especially between the two, because modernism does seem to be compatible with both of them, but each of them take their own way and emphasize something very particular by going their own way in this way. And I think it comes back to the dichotomy can be mostly exemplified by what you said about synthetic environments. And I think it has, so you mentioned that, well, this is an interesting way to tie in your sort of virtue theory of architecture, where with Le Corbusier and his urban planning and his sort of I'm thinking of the first, not the first passage in Descartes' Discours on Method, but Descartes also mentions something like, you know, these winding roads, they just pop up ad hoc. It's just so ugly. If we could just, you know, level the city and build it according to one plan, it would be so much better. And our sciences should be like that as well. Well, I mean, Le Corbusier wants to do that too. He's following in a modernist tradition by emphasizing the is the ignorance of the surrounding environment. Is that the right word for it? In any case, he wants to do away with consideration for
rejection. Yeah, I feel like it's the
better word. Yeah, a rejection of the surrounding environment for his own plan, whereas Frank Lloyd Wright specifically considers that, and it points to a character, a virtue character of each of their buildings. And you mentioned it's Le Corbusier's buildings are imposing, they have their own presence, they stand over and above their surrounding environments. If you look at the Villa Savoy, it sort of just exists free-floating in the center of a field, essentially. And if you look at the Unité d'Habitation, it's a singular building that just arises and goes quite high, actually, irregardless of whatever buildings might be next to it. It's not designed to look beautiful next to any other particular building. It just has to exist. Whereas with that's one of the comments that Wright actually makes in his interview. The interviewer asks about the New York City cityscape, the skyline there, and he says, no, I would, it, like, there's no planning, what's going on, like, there's nothing here, which is ironic considering the enormous amount of planning that goes into Le Corbusier's buildings. It's it plans up to the walls and then it stops there. There's no consideration for what's around it. It's almost sort of selfish. The buildings are selfish in a way, if we want to personify them in that way. But Wright's buildings aren't like that. Again, to take the example of Falling Water, it's surprising how well kind of jutting terraces, but these balconies come out into beautiful wood. And they don't look out of place at all, even though Wright is following in the modernist vocabulary of square, plaster, concrete, reinforced metal and brick and whatnot. It doesn't look out of place at all. It has the character of being subdued, unlike Le Corbusier's works, where the building is meant to obviously have its own presence, but it doesn't overwhelm or overpower the surrounding nature. It doesn't try to hide the trees. It runs into them. The water that runs underneath the building has a, it's almost like a little dock. There's a set of stairs that come out to